there, welcome to Radio Utopistan. So happy you tuned in again. My name is Elisabeth Veit. Welcome to our window of hope and inspiration in a world that seems pretty dark at the moment. Of course, there are always sparks of light to be found, otherwise we wouldn't be doing what we are doing here. And we even have some good news from our side. This year we will expand in doing workshops and events on how to deal with this dark, dark world out there. How to find constructive stories for yourself and for others. Because we strongly believe one of the best cures against all the catastrophes out there is building community and finding ways to act. Steps, any steps, towards a more just future, however small they might seem at first glance. And the world really needs them. Just the last few weeks we saw secret plans of mass deportation uncovered in Germany, drug cartels unleashing a massive wave of violence upon Ecuador, and the still ongoing bombing and starving in Palestine, the crises in Congo and Sudan, and also, of course, the ongoing destruction of nature all around the planet. Many of you sent messages about how you are losing hope and energy to do something about all this, that you become depressed, paralyzed, and angry by the state of the world. Of course you do. Me too, I have to say. It's a challenge to stay hopeful and see meaning in the little acts that we can do to change things. But it is possible. And today I will tell you a story from Ecuador to prove it to you. To give you a best practice example and maybe some ideas for how to organize or support a successful social movement. The story is about nature and justice, about how our legal systems work and how they can be used as guardians of nature. The story is about the revolutionary idea to see and treat nature as a legal subject, in front of the law and in our daily lives. This is basically the topic of my first book, Die Natur hat Recht. Nature has rights, nature is right. I put it in the show notes and I'm very happy if you check it out. Here and now we focus on one of the groundbreaking cases in this now global movement, the Los Cedros case. Los Cedros is a subtropical cloud forest in northern Ecuador. It is a magical place with mosses, lianas, and misty fog hanging between giant trees, thousands of birds, and even some pumas. Walking, or better climbing through it, you expect elves or other mystical creatures jumping into your way. But then it's just monkeys, at least at first sight. We slightly touched the rights of nature topic in two previous episodes already. One time, while talking with Carlos Soria about a copper mine project, also in Ecuador, and another time with Helena Golinga talking about oil and abundance in the Amazon. You can go back and check them out if you want. Today we talk with Elisa Levi Ortiz. She is a biologist and part of the social movement in the legal case around the Los Cedros rainforest. But first, I want to give you a rough overview about the concept of nature as a legal person, nature as a subject instead of an object. What does that even mean? Where does it come from? And why is it so relevant? I'd say it's the beginning of a revolution. It is about treating nature as a partner instead of a supermarket that we can exploit and exploit and exploit. It's about seeing ourselves as part of nature. And with this, rights of nature, they have the potential power to change everything. The way we relate to nature and the way we relate to ourselves and other humans. How we organize our economy, our food supply, our transportation systems, our housing, everything. It's a worldview. Rights of nature, or nature as a legal subject, it's about oneness and collaboration and solidarity instead of separation, exploitation and oppression, as we've seen so many centuries now. And it's for plants and for people. It's just for all beings. That's the idea behind it, no? Everything is a being. Everything is living. And this way, it is also a decolonizing instrument to end any kind of supremacy or othering to name the post-colonial concept of Palestinian scholar Edward Said. But yeah, Rights of Nature, it's a project that could reverse the structures that colonialism and patriarchy brought upon our planet. Some say Rights of Nature are a bigger shift for humanity than the abolition of slavery was, or women's rights to vote. We'll see about that, because so far it is just in the beginning and mostly words on paper. We do not have so many practical examples like the Los Cedros case. And in concrete terms, it means, of course, it has to be humans that implement those rights of nature. An avocado tree or a cow, they cannot go to court, obvious. But people can, on their behalf. And in Ecuador, for example, every citizen can file a lawsuit. Rights of nature now, and it doesn't mean that you cannot cut down trees anymore or kill cows to eat them, but it means that you cannot destroy entire ecosystems. You cannot exploit nature. You have to live with her and respect her. What exactly this means or could mean in individual cases, this is what people all over the world are trying to figure out right now. In Ecuador, for example, there have been more or less 60 cases so far about the rights of nature. And more than half of them were decided in favor of nature. That meant, for example, that a copper mine was not allowed to be built or dams were not allowed to be built. And the Rights of Nature movement is already a global movement. More than 400 initiatives are pushing it further, and in almost 40 countries, we now have laws that are somehow working with this concept. For example, there are ecosystems like rivers, lakes, or forests in New Zealand, India, Colombia, Panama, or Spain that now count as legal subjects, as legal persons in front of the law. Ecuador plays a very special role in all this because it is the first and so far only country in the world where this concept of nature as a legal person is implemented on a constitutional level. It basically means nature is one of the foundations around which the entire state is organized, at least on paper. In 2008, the people of Ecuador gave themselves this new and revolutionary constitution. And already in the first sentence, it is honoring and celebrating Pachamama, the indigenous spiritual belief around Mother Earth, Mother Nature. What I found interesting is that nature as a legal subject, it also has its roots in Western philosophy and even in Western law systems. Alexander von Humboldt, for example, or Karlowitz, and then from the legal side, Christopher Stone from the US. I could tell you so many things about that, but go read my book, and this shall not be like 1,000 hours now. And we want to talk to Elisa. But another core message of the Ecuador's constitution I want to share is everybody shall be able to lead a good life, buen vivir, they call it. But all this is what is written, it's words. Now, in reality, Ecuador is not doing well at all. Drug gangs are taking over, violence and poverty are spreading. How can nature rights then be of any importance or just be implemented when the state even fails to protect human rights? We talk about this later. First, Los Cedros and the biologist Elisa Levik Ortiz. I visited her last year on her organic farm close to the nature reserve in northern Ecuador. Together with her family and friends, she's growing bananas, yucca, coffee, and vegetables. We had met before in Germany at a conference around rights of nature in the University of Tübingen. And to Elisa, rights of nature, they are the logical consequence of what the laws of nature itself are in the forest.
As a biologist, you know, it makes a lot of sense. You study the ecosystems and all the relationships that happen between all the different organisms in nature, and it's such a fragile ecosystem and like a fragile reality, so it makes a lot of sense that nature has rights. And I guess, you know, not just from a biologist, I guess from a human point of being, you know, we even though no matter where you're from or where you live or what you do, whatever, one way or another, you acknowledge that you depend on nature, you know, whether it's for the weather, for the rain, or from a more, like scientist maybe point of view, you know, like studying all the like the different relationships and how everything exists, like why this plant has that shape of leaf or why that flower has that shape or the color. Like everything has a reason and a purpose in nature and an ecosystem, and everything is connected. So, you know, it makes a lot of sense, because even though we as humans, we might not perceive when all that like balance is broken, what can happen maybe on a medium or long term, you know, like the pandemic was literally a product or a result of that balance being broken. You know, like the animals don't have their ecosystem anymore, so they, you know, getting more in contact with the humans, blah, blah, blah. And that basically the pandemic is a product of that balance being broken. So, yeah, like from a technical point of view, it makes a lot of sense that the nature have rights, because we literally depend on it. Mm-hmm. All not just humans, but, you know, humans, we tend to be selfish, I guess, but everything depends on nature.
I like how she is talking about balance and nature here, that nature needs to be in balance to be healthy. Justice also needs balance. That's why in so many courthouses we still have Justitia, the goddess of justice, holding a scale in her hand. Elisa loves justice with her heart and is a biologist by profession. She also holds a master's degree in communication and development focused on environmental communication, which helped a lot in the Los Cedros case, what she will tell you. She has worked for several years in various research and conservation projects, mainly in northern Ecuador. And since 2018, she is with the Los Cedros Biological Reserve as a research coordinator and engaging the local communities in sustainable and participatory initiatives. All this is to protect the rainforest against mining and against logging, because the subtropical rainforest of Los Cedros is one of the most biodiverse places left on our planet. There are more than 300 species of just birds and 400 species of just orchids living in Elisa's workplace. It was life-changing for her to arrive there, she says.
When I went to university to study biology, I had this idea that, you know, yeah, Ecuador is biodiverse and everything's perfect, you know, like we have all these ecosystems, but you don't really get any idea of what's happening or what are the threats to those very special ecosystems. So, you know, when I arrived there, you know, with this research project and everything was the biodiversity and the species and blah, 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 blah. And of course, you know, we had an idea of the threats. But, you know, after realizing that many of these areas were under mining concessions, that was something that I didn't really acknowledge at all. So to me, it meant really, I guess, like a process of realizing that, yes, we have this gorgeous biodiversity and this beautiful country, but there are so many threats. Okay, I mean, I really like doing research, but what's the point of doing all that research and gathering all that information or whatever, if all these very special forests are threatened by big scale mining?
Los Cedros is a magical place. I had the chance to visit it with a group of birdwatchers and walked up the mountains with them. The highest point is on 2,700 meters altitude. We didn't get that far, but almost. And we saw many birds, some monkeys, and the footsteps of a puma. And a bear. The footsteps, I mean. And you walk through giant trees full of other plants, you climb over trunks full of mushrooms, and you find your way through lianas, lichens, and mosses. It's really breathtaking to walk through there, in this dense forest. And every tree itself is a whole new ecosystem with hundreds of species living on just one tree, like bromelias and lianas and other plants. The conservation project of Los Cedros started with José de Cu. He is a special character, living up there since more than 30 years now, really living up there in the mountains. And so he became himself part of this cloud forest ecosystem, like a friendly and sometimes grumpy fungi or mushroom or nymphemia. He is sitting behind his desk in the open community space, surrounded by hundreds of books that became themselves habitats for mushrooms or mosses and grass and things, species, beings. He's from the US, but doesn't feel much related to it anymore. He ran away from it, he says, and found this beautiful forest in Ecuador and set up camp.
It's a Save the Tropical Forest project. I came here to try to do something like this, and I've ended up doing it. That's just one of those things. You better watch out what you set out to do, because you might end up doing it. So I'm still here after 30 years, and the project's grown. Now I'm nearing the end of the old trail. I'm going to the last roundup pretty soon, and I'm developing a replacement crew to take over. You need somebody to live here. It's not a thankless task. You certainly do get credit for what you do, but at the same time, it's a constant thing. There's never been any relaxation. There's always been it's like you're fighting the greed of greed in as many ways, shapes, and forms.
But what does it mean for you personally, like for your heart, for your soul? What is Los Cedros for you that kept you here for 30 years and all the conflict, all the fighting, all the discussions? What is it? What gives Los Cedros to you? What is it? How what is Los Cedros for you?
Somebody's got to do it. Somebody's got to do it.
Like somebody has to wash the dishes?
Yeah, somebody's got to do it. I mean, it's no trouble. It's not unpleasant. But you know, somebody's got to live it. Some people got to do it. Somebody's got to make those decisions that you got to, you know, give up the rest of it and get to it. Now, over 30 years, of course, it's not the same as when I first got here. You know, that was quite primitive. I was camping more or less for years, and kerosene lamps and a wooden fire pit. So it's a bit different these days. Today, there's almost, you know, practically speaking, there's even hot water in the shower.
Indeed, there is even hot water in the shower now, and a very skillful kitchen team. Also, since some years already, Los Cedros is a so-called bosque protector, a forest that is actually already granted special protection by the Ministry of Environment of Ecuador, on top of the general rights of nature. Nevertheless, there were always threats from mining companies and loggers that wanted to exploit the forest. Copper, gold, the trees. And then in 2017, the Environmental Ministry, the Environmental Ministry gave mining concessions and a permission to do open pit copper mining here to a Canadian mining company.
La flor del madroño huele así.
Martin Obando is also part of the Los Cedros ecosystem and the court case. He was born on a farm in the area, and since almost 30 years he's working in the cloud forest as a guide. On our hike, he sometimes stopped and said, "Wait, I can smell something. There must be this and that animal close by, or this and that plant." Como vanilla.
Sí.
Es vanilla.
Dicen que la primer vainilla que inventaron, sacaron de esta.
Ah, están bonitos.
Ahora ya todo es artificial.
He speaks the language of the forest, so to say, and he learned a lot more, he says.
Uno va aprendiendo, va experimentando, y se da cuenta cómo es tan sabia, tan perfecta.
One is learning how nature is so wise, so perfect, that one is connected with the other.
Que el uno está conectado con el otro, somos un mismo mundo.
We are the same world, the humans, the plant, and the animal. When we are more involved, we understand better.
Esto es muy,
because
muy
there is no other way to understand and to value if we are not involved in it.
Entendemos mejor, porque no hay otra forma de entender y de valorar si no estamos involucrados en la misma.
Martin was speaking as a so-called amicus curiae in front of the Constitutional Court, as a person, witness, or expert invited by one of the conflicting parties. The highest court in the country had chosen the Los Cedros case as a special case to strengthen the constitution with it. Otherwise, it would have taken years to bring it in front of the highest court in the country. A lower provincial court already had ruled that the mine can be opened. This court had not seen any contradiction in rights of nature and large-scale mining in a protected area. Corruption is big in Ecuador, but so is biodiversity and people who love nature. And the judges of the Constitutional Court apparently love their constitution more than money. So in December 21,
For the first time in human history, a court clearly and irretrievably recognized the rights of nature in a specific case. It was the final decision because you cannot appeal against the Constitutional Court. And this one banned the mining project and ruled that no activities that threaten the rights of nature are permitted in the Los Cedros cloud forest ecosystem ever. This ruling is an important milestone in the global movement for the rights of nature. It shows that these rights can be enforced, not only in theory, but also in practice. The ruling already had an effect on other similar cases in Ecuador and other countries. It's also a very vivid example of how it is not only the courts or the law system who implement the law, but civil society. Even in a country like Ecuador, where corruption is high and poverty and violence are spreading, even here, the law can be implemented if civil society is strong. And Elisa was part of this civil society and part of the Los Cedros campaign between 2018 and 2021.
On one hand, we got together with a group of friends, you know, and started to kind of from zero, you know, learning what's big scale mining, what does it mean, what's the impact. We, after learning what can happen in an area like Los Cedros if a project move on, it was just like, you know, what are we going to do about it? So decided to present a legal case. There was like this sort of urgency. The concession, it's already there. The mining company, it's already there. What we can do about it? And then, you know, it was very important to realize that, you know, one thing was the legal case, but also another crucial thing was all the campaign, you know, like the communication and the constant pressure in social media and a communication campaign, you know, saying why Los Cedros is important, why Los Cedros, you know, shouldn't be mined. And at the end, the judges, it was really nice to hear from them that in addition to the legal case itself, that all the campaign that we built was a key in visibilizing, you know, one thing is what happens with the legal process, but also that people and also the judges saw that people was concerned and that there were so many reasons why a forest like Los Cedros shouldn't be mined. So it was very nice for all of us, I guess, to feel that all that work and all that effort that you were doing was going into something that could make a difference for a place like Los Cedros. That this might sound cliche, but like it was useful for something. You know, it wasn't just like you're doing a research and maybe a publication or whatever, but all this hard work was directed to a great cause, and that at the end, you know, because in many points of all this process that took so many years, we weren't sure what was going to happen. You know, there's so much corruption here and so much pressure from the government, and these mining companies have so much money that many times we thought, you know, that we were just kind of wasting our time because, you know, there was a high chance that maybe the judges will get corrupted. I don't know. You know, yeah. So it was a lot of like ups and downs and a lot of uncertainty because we didn't knew, you know, what was the verdict, what was going to be like. You know, we always thought that, oh, there's going to be so much pressure that the judges, even though they might want to have like a positive verdict for the forest, but maybe with all the pressure, which also has happened before and even after the Los Cedros verdict, that maybe, you know, nothing was going to happen. But at the end, you know, realizing the importance of a verdict like Los Cedros and how that sent a very important precedent, that was like a more exhaustive thing to be always constantly saying, you know, this is happening, this is at risk, and, you know, telling the country and the world what's at risk with this verdict, you know, what can we lose or what can we win if we have a verdict in favor of the forest. So, and, you know, it's always really nice to remember, you know, all that process and at the end that what was accomplished with that. I think it's very important, not just for us, but I think in general to kind of show that hope that actually we, after all, that we shouldn't sort of doubt, I guess, in the process of what can happen at the end, but just, you know, give it all, trying, wishing the best. And that luckily sometimes, I mean, I know the reality is not always like this, but I guess always keep the hope that things can be for good. For the best. Mm.
Yeah, and you succeeded in one of the most important verdicts that happened in rights of nature here in Ecuador and maybe even in the world.
Maybe I should be more optimistic about it, but I think in the reality there is still a lot of challenges for it to be fully implemented.
Of course, there are challenges, especially in Ecuador, which has a very high level of corruption, where you cannot really trust the government or the judges, and a huge percentage of the country is under concessions. So, of course, it's fragile. It's so far still most of all words on paper, and then there are some example cases like the Los Cedros example case. Yeah,
yeah. I wish I could have like a more positive answer to that question, but I think, you know, it's important, like I said, because despite all these challenges, a president like Los Cedros gives us hope that despite all this scenario, you know, with the corruption and everything, and the power of mining companies and the interests of the government, which is clearly, you know, very capitalistic and exploiting the resources, you know, something can be done. Like, that tool exists and it's all right. And even though we face those challenges, you know, we can always insist that that we're not just saying that because we want the forest to be protected. We're saying that because it's in our constitution, you know. It's not just because we want to or because we feel like it. We have that backup, I guess, that support, that it's a constitutional right. So it's definitely a very important tool, despite all the challenges that we have mentioned. It is great to have that, you know, and not just say like, oh, we want to protect the forest because we like the forest. It's, no, you know, we're far beyond that debate, you know. It's a constitutional right.
Yeah. As a biologist, you say it makes totally sense that nature has rights. Mm-hmm. Can you describe a little bit for us how nature also is a being? Like, we are human beings, and nature, I mean, already making this difference between nature and humans doesn't really make sense. Humans are also nature. Human beings and, I don't know, the plant beings, even the annoying mosquito beings and everything is beings. Can you describe for us, from your biologist view, how those beings are working together and living together?
Yeah, most of those beings have been evolving even before that, from, you know, even before humans existed. So nature as a forest, as an organism, you know, like, everything has to function for the whole thing to exist. Because, for example, a very important ecological service from the forest is water, for example. But if somehow you intervene or you cut the forest itself, the capacity of a forest to produce or hold water, it's widely affected, you know, if the forest is not like primary forest itself. So, for example, there's a study that was done in the Andean region of Ecuador that it proved that the quality of the water and the amount of water decrease like 70 or 75% if the forest was not primary. So when you have a primary forest, the amount...
What's a primary forest? What's a primary forest?
Oh, a primary forest is like a forest that hasn't been touched, like a native forest or primary forest, yes. So, yeah, I mean, so there's like all this relationship, you know, are very fragile in terms of the capacity of a forest to produce water, of the presence of a species. For example, there are many species of plants that have co-evolved with, for example, hummingbirds. And there are some species that have like a very tight and fragile relationship. So, for example, if a particular species of flower disappears, maybe that hummingbird is gonna, you know, like, run out of its source of food, and, you know, might go extinct. And so everything in nature, as everything in our body, has a purpose, you know, like, whether it's the, like, you know, to see, to eat, whatever, to digest, whatever, you know, the forest itself is the same thing. Like, every species has its role. And the forest itself, you know, that fragile relationship, it's composed of the presence of all those species and animals and plants, but also the relationship they have. And many things, you know, there are so many things on those relationships, like I said, that are very fragile, that if one species might go extinct, the other one. But then, you know, that might lead to sort of like a snowball effect, that, you know, we might see at the beginning that it's just that species that got extinct, but then, you know, in the long term, that might affect for the whole ecosystem itself and how it functions and how it maintains that equilibrium and how, you know, everything that happens under the soil that we don't even see, all those relationships, and how organisms like fungi, that are some of them microscopic but are so key for, you know, the forest, for its communication and for the exchange of like informations and how the, for example, the fungi, even though we don't see them, they're so key in the soil because they help the plants basically absorb the nutrients. Otherwise, maybe, you know, we won't have such a diverse and dense forest if it wasn't for those. And so many things we don't even know, you know, of how it works and how can it be affected by a road or by, you know, cutting down a tree here or there.
And when you say every little being in nature has its task or role to fulfill to keep the wheel running, exactly, or to keep the whole ecosystem running, mm-hmm, do you see a role that we humans have?
Maybe, you know, maybe as individuals. I mean, there are some individuals that are doing great things for nature, but as a species, the nature, the world itself would be much better off without the humans, for sure. Yeah, I mean, as a species in an ecosystem, we just take, humans as a species, we just take resources. It's not like we, even though, like I said, individuals are doing great things all over the world here and there, but as a species, we're just like sucking everything and without giving back anything to nature itself. We're not part of a harmonic relationship, you know, even though, like I said, individuals are doing great things, but as a species, we're not part of that.
Are we a fail in the system or what?
Yeah, we're definitely the only species that is messing up with all that balance that naturally, nature itself and most of these species have evolved thousands of years before us, you know, like adapting to the ecosystem, adapting to the presence of other animals and plants, figuring out what's, maybe speaking as a plant, like what's the best size that I should have or the shape of my leaves in order to adapt myself to these ecosystems and with these predators and with these soil conditions. I mean, for every single species, you know, it has taken them thousands of years to kind of figure out and adapt to the ecosystem and be able to be part of that balance. And, you know, humans, we just arrived and we just, you know, destroy and take. And so it's definitely, we're messing everything up, basically, yeah.
And what could we learn from nature then?
Well, I think on one hand, we can try to be more part of this ecosystem, you know, like more conscious that every single action that we do is going to impact, you know, whether the soil where I am or whether where my, I don't know, my food comes from. I mean, try to realize, you know, what's the impact of ourselves as an individual or as a species in the ecosystem and our surroundings, you know, like what my actions, how my actions and what I eat, what I do, what I, yeah, how's that impacting my ecosystem, my surroundings, you know. And then in relation to Los Cedros, what can we learn to Los Cedros? I guess, you know, to have hope that despite, and that's something that we always like to remember, you know, with the people that was involved in there, that, like I said, many times we thought, you know, that, you know, we were just going to lose and nothing was going to be accomplished. But I guess Los Cedros, even for us and for many people, you know, brings hope that despite everything, something can be done. And I guess without hope, you know, what's the point of trying to do something about all this, of everything that's happening in our world, that it's so messed up, so unbalanced. You can keep going about all the tragic things in the world, but I guess we have to stick to these cases or these realities that despite everything can be so messed up, you know, there's hope and that actually things, you can get surprised by what you can achieve and you should try, you know, why not? Mm-hmm. Give it a try.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think made you succeed? I mean, we just talked about the challenges with the corruption and the not trustworthy government and all the mining concessions. What do you think helped make the case win and Los Cedros be protected for at least the next, I don't know how many years, many years? And what was it?
I think it was like the sum, the add of many, many people helping from many different expertise and many different aspects. There's this nice word in Spanish, Minga. It's actually a Quechua word. Many people from like different expertise, you know, like the people that communications, the lawyers, the scientists, you know, it was really nice to see as the process moved on from the county level to the provincial level and then to the national constitutional court level, how many people were starting to care about this, you know, because everything started like just a case in the county court of Cotacachi, another case. And then, you know, we lost at that, at the first instance. And then, you know, when we appeal, it kind of, everything got bigger and bigger. And, you know, there was more interest from the people in the city, in the province, in the country. And, you know, just people from different parts of the world, organizations that have helped Los Cedros before this. So just, you know, people in general, they help with the, for example, doing little videos, you know, like, oh, you know, we can do a video. We can, okay, great. Or we can, you know, create like this small sort of reels to publish in, you know, social media. Or when the case got to the Constitutional Court, we had 70, it was like 100 and something, but 70 something people speaking in favor of Los Cedros, like scientists from all over the world speaking in favor of Los Cedros and why a mining project in a forest like this shouldn't move on. So I guess it was that, you know, it was like the contribution of many lawyers. Most of them voluntarily review the case itself and said, you know, hey, we should include this, we should do that. And how, on one hand, it was a legal case, but then on the other, like the other very important support for the case was the social pressure, the constant social pressure. And for example, nonprofits and many organizations, you know, like for example in Twitter, that how to push, you know, institutions and the judges itself directly, how, you know, everyone was helping with that. Because, yeah, I mean, at the beginning, you know, it was just like a very small group, you know, that we were trying sort of figure out, because we had no idea, you know, how can we support the legal case. But then it just started growing and growing. So it was, it's the Minga, you know, it's like contributing to a cause and trying to make like a big team, a multidisciplinary team, and also learning from previous experiences. On one hand, many countries in the region have been facing these issues. So, you know, what can we learn from them? You know, like we talk with people or and also now friends from Colombia, Peru, you know, what have you done that makes sense, that has been successful?
What was that?
For example, the campaign, you know, like you know, that we shouldn't just feel that with legal case that was all we could do, and not think about that a communication strategy could help. For example, at the beginning, many of us, we were like, you know, but if we build like a strong legal case, maybe that's all we can do. And they were like, no, you have to have the social pressure, the constant. And that was like, you know, it was like a constant campaign from 2018 to 2021. Like, you know, every once in a while, you know, like do whether a new video or interview scientists and have them talk and, you know, share that widely in social media and with all the collaborators. So it was that, to realize that it was not just a legal case. It was also the constant pressure and the communication campaign. That was, I think, the success of it, you know, despite, of course, you know, like the legal case itself, but it was how so many people from all over the world contributed to this cause. It was beautiful.
I like that you compare it with a Minga, which is a very traditional thing here in Ecuador, but I think all in the Andean region, right? Mm-hmm. And it means that people get together to do some work, for example, fix a road, mm-hmm. like, and everybody brings whatever he or she can bring. Some bring food, some bring stones, some bring tools, some just bring their labor, and at the end, the road is fixed.
Exactly. Yeah?
So, and at the end, Los Cedros is protected. That's beautiful.
And it was with the help of many people from literally all over the world. And it was, mm-hmm. I think, otherwise it wouldn't have happened, but it happened. And we couldn't believe it when we got, when the case was chosen by the Constitutional Court. It's like, it's going to be debated in the Constitutional Court.
And how was it when the sentence was done? Do you remember the moment when you got the news that the court said the mining company has to go?
Yeah, that was a very, like, you know, in my particular case, I was, I got a scholarship and I was doing a master's in the United States, in the U.S., and I was doing an interview because, you know, I was studying in Ohio, and that's an area that has been affected by coal mining, you know, coal mines from 100 years ago, and they are still dealing with acid mine drainage. And I was actually interviewing a scientist who's working on acid mine drainage, you know, for many years. And it was very shocking and interesting. That's a whole new, a different story. But to see how this area in Southeast Ohio was dealing with, you know, the impacts from mining from 100 years. So I was doing some interviews for a class project, and, you know, my phone started like ringing and everything. And I was like, literally, like, you know, doing the interview. And I was like, I'm sorry, something, I thought something was happening with, I don't know, like family or something. And they just say, you know, there was like the sentence out, and it's like we won, and it's sorry. It was just, I was like trying to you know, I had to ask for, like, for this, for her, like, you know, like, I need a minute, something. I mean, like, yeah, it was really nice. But then, you know, it was just, okay, we won, but what does it say? You know, how far it goes? And then, you know, it took a while because, you know, and then I remember I went back to my place and I was trying to read it, but it was, you know, it was like a 200 and something sentence, you know, but then I just went to the end and it was just like, yeah, I mean, we had to read it over and over again because it's so beautiful, you know, it's so well written because it's so clear about what rights were violated and what should be done to repair that and, you know, all the precedent. And it makes a lot of sense because they took a while to publish it, but it's so well written, you know, it doesn't leave like a double interpretation, something like that, you know, it's very straightforward. So it was beautiful to read it. And, you know, it took a while to really acknowledge that was it, you know, and that's it. And that was the sentence, that was the verdict, you know, it's not something that you can appeal or something that's going to change, you know, that was it. That was the result of all those years. So it was really nice. And it's a beautiful verdict. It's beautiful.
Yeah, I also read some sentences, not all the 200 and something pages, but I read through it. And I liked, especially, I remember one phrase, it's something like, this is not lyrics.
Rhetorical, yeah.
Oh, this is not rhetorical, it's in English. Yeah. This is not rhetorical, this is serious.
Yeah,
The rights of nature, take them serious. It's not lyrical. Yeah, yeah, I like that.
Yeah, there are many parts that, you know, were like, really, like, the, you know, the a verdict from the Constitutional Court is saying this, like, so clear and so strong.
Yeah, it's really, it's a landmark ruling. It's really epic and historical, and it will, well, it is already setting the standards for so many other cases. And what would be your advice for any group of friends or organization or people who are trying to protect nature, not already wanting to have a landmark ruling case, but doing whatever to protect nature?
Hope. I mean, don't lose the hope that things can be different. And also learn from others. Be open and be humble to ask other organizations or other people, because there are many people that have, or organizations that have gone through this, you know, whether it's an issue with a mining company or with, I don't know, like deforestation or illegal.
There are so many things. Water pollution, roads.
Exactly. There's like someone that, or someone or an organization that already went through this. So you can save so much energy and time and resources if you just are open to asking, you know, for help or for information or learning from others. Like, you know, what makes sense, especially with the campaign, you know, like, where should we put our efforts? Because most of the time, you know, all the work around this case, especially with the campaign, was all volunteers. So it's not like you have the expert in communication and all the resources, you know, to gather. And it's like, no, you have no resources. And, you know, like, you want to be very strategic on how you direct that energy and the time. So in terms of saving yourself frustration and everything, just ask people, what's the best strategy? And have a strategy, because, you know, like, you have to somehow try to have, you know, what's the goal and what we want to achieve and how we're going to achieve. It's very important, you know, not like such a very formal thing, but at least certain things that you need to have clear, you know, what's the point of doing what we're doing. And, you know, it was really crazy to see how sometimes, you know, at the beginning we had like a small como se dice, plantón, like protest, you know, in front of an institution, maybe with 10, 15 people. But if we properly, you know, contact the journalist or the TV, like the traditional, because, you know, you want to get to the people that don't know, because what's the point of having the people that already know what's happening and are concerned? But if you were, you know, if you manage that properly, even though like a small action with maybe 15, 20 people in the street can have like an impact. So always think about, because if, you know, many of the actions, if those actions are not like seen by other people, they don't have that impact. And maybe it's a waste of energy and time. So that was also something that we always kept in mind. Okay, like, if we're going to do this, if we're going to put our efforts in this, it has to have that impact, or, you know, reach to whoever we wanted to reach, whether it's the judges or the media or just the people.
Okay. I get you. Let's get to our three favorite last questions. One is, what's your utopistan, like the dream world you would love to live in?
I think I'm living on it right now.
Can you describe it for the people who are not sitting here with us?
Yeah, I think I'm... Yeah, I think it's nice that we asked you this question because, just yesterday we were celebrating the first year since my partner and I moved to this little property that we bought. And that for me is like living the dream, you know, like living away from that routine and those like the pressure, like from especially like urban areas or a job from like Monday to Friday or from, I don't know, 8 to 5 and stuff like that. From that, like, routine and that like pressure of, you know, you have to be productive and do this, and if you're not working from Monday to Friday, you're not productive, and if you don't have like the, I don't know, it's like moving away from that and being here and setting your own routine. And of course, you know, it has its challenges and everything, but to me this is like living the dream. This is my utopistan. This little place, and you know, like deciding what you're going to do each day, like whether planting or maybe just chilling or maybe, yeah, like walking around with dogs. And yeah, this is my utopistan.
Yeah, and it's beautiful, and I had the honor to visit it for some time. And would you also see that on a society level, or is that your personal private dream?
I think I'm more concerned about my own wellness, yeah. But I also think that, you know, because, you know, when friends visit, you know, it's like people that come and see, like, oh, you live here, and, you know, like, this is it, this is, yeah, I mean, this is all you need, like a small house of 5 meters by 6, like, this is, yeah, you don't need more. I mean, and I think it's nice to sort of, you know, for people to realize that, you know, and that you can grow your food, and, of course, you know, You need other resources from outside, or there, all the challenges that imply to living in the rural areas and try to live out of, you know, farming and stuff. But I think it's nice to, I guess, for the society, I don't know if that sounds proper, but to show that you can live simple, and that, you know, and prioritize that wellness, you know, of that it's not easy, and I know it's also comes from like certain privilege of having the, you know, the, I guess, the support of, you know, being able to have like whether another income from, you know, whether what your profession or whatever. I mean, I know that not many people can sort of just, you know, go to the field and have make it, build a small house or whatever. But I guess to show that to the people, to the, you know, yeah, like, to show that to the society that you can live a simple life and show that there are other alternatives of a lifestyle. I think that also can be sort of a contribution for new societies.
Okay, so normally the question would now be, do you have examples, numbers, or something that your utopia is more and more coming true? You have it, right? We're sitting just next to it.
Yeah.
And then the final question is, how could people help this utopia come more and more true? And now, not of course for you, but for themselves.
Well, speaking of Los Cedros, I think, you know, because now we're facing, of course, like more challenges about, you know, sustaining the scientific station and working with the communities. I think visiting Los Cedros will directly help for that. Because, you know, yeah, like we somehow overcame the threat of the mining concession. But, you know, it's been really hard for Los Cedros to, for example, get funding, because you are like sort of in the blacklist for the government and the Ministry of Environment. And unfortunately, many funds that come for conservation in Ecuador sort of go through the Ministry of Environment. So you can imagine that, you know, if Los Cedros sued the Ministry of Environment for granting a mining concession, we are in the black list. So it's been hard to sustain the place and have like a proper management of all the reserves. So visiting the reserve will definitely help for whoever wants to visit and support that process and that conservation, the conservation of that forest to move on. So even the crickets are applauding now.
Yeah.
To your...
And the full moon.
And the full moon in the back. Wow, this is amazing. Thank you so much.
This is my Utopistan.
This is your Utopistan. Yeah. I'm happy I can live it for 24 hours with you. Thank you so much, Elisa, not just for this interview, but for all the work you do, because it's obviously very helpful and important.
Thanks for those words, Tokaya.
Tokaya, this is how you call someone who is sharing the same first name with you. So, I hope my Ecuadorian Tokaya could give you some hope, inspiration, and concrete tools along your way, whatever Utopistan you are working on. She and the whole Los Cedros campaign definitely gave me the courage and inspiration to do the watermelon protests with my friend Lena just after the Gaza bombing started. We can all learn so much from each other, as Elisa was saying. The three key takeaways for me in the Los Cedros case are: every little act counts, especially when you have a broad movement. Even sharing things on social media is crucial so a movement can succeed. Second, justice needs more than just laws and courts, and you cannot rely on this juridical system to implement justice. You have to take action to activate the system, to hold it accountable. My third key takeaway is, I guess it's almost everywhere, storytelling is king or queen. If Elisa and the movement hadn't had this captivating story to tell about Los Cedros, about nature and justice and the future of the planet, they could not have reached so many people and even convinced them to become active themselves and help them build their Utopistan. What are your key takeaways? What is your Utopistan? Tell us, post it on social media and tag us. Let's have a discussion around effective campaigns. To connect with Elisa and the Los Cedros movement, you can follow OMASNA or GARN, the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature. I will put everything in the show notes. Thank you so much for being here and listening to the very end. Radio Utopistan is a non-profit media house working on a more just future via constructive storytelling. You can support us via Patreon or our website. For taxpayers in Germany, you even get a tax refund for your donation because we are officially recognized as benefiting the common good. Tatam. Radio Utopistan team for this episode are me and my fellow utopista Christina Femubos and the sound saver Andres Galassa. I leave you with a song from Sarayaku in the Amazon, another utopian story. You can learn more about it in our previous episode. Salam and bye bye.
Uraimanda Wairawas Mana ushamushka achuia Hawamanda Wairawas Mana ushamushka tachuia Kausai manda Wairaga Ushawara Panilla Urai manda Wairawas Tachuia, Tintel manda Wairawas, Manaun Shauska Tachuia, Urai manda Wairatiru, Anang manda Wairawas, Manaun Shauska Tachuia, Cielo manda Wairawas, Manaun Shauska Tachuia, Kausai manda Wairaga, Usawara Panilla, chuya anang manda waira was manang samus kata chuya kausa e manda waira ga usa wara warmia kausa e manda waira was usa wara